Ruth Garbernheim from University of Virginia. There I am. And it is a pleasure to be here today. I'm going to try to make my talk pretty fast so that we can really talk about the different ways that we probably all in the room are teaching. I have been teaching with Richard Bonney in the law school and with others for about 12 years, 15 years, public health law. And our we have been an evolving approach to teaching so that from the very beginning we have included public health students and medical students in our class, so you were a perfect segue to me. And our evolution has been towards making this an experience that is not even so much about public health law, but about public health. And in some ways that was because we have been driven by examining the values that are important for all lawyers, not just people who are going into public health law. So it started for the first edition of the Goodman book, and Rick and Tony came up and we talked, and so we wrote the first chapter of ethics in that book. So we taught a classic law for a while, and I have no relationships to disclose, so sorry. And so this is sort of out of Gosson's book, and you can see the structure that we taught it with, and that more and more emphasis now is the laws that impact health, health and all policies, et cetera. So that's our framework. We taught it in a very formal way in the beginning, classic law. Now we have totally, I hate this term because it sounds like we're trying to be cool now, that flipped the classroom is in vogue. Have you all heard in the law school about flipped classrooms? Well, we were doing it before it was cool, and it works. So that we now, our course is about providing cases from practice. It's good decision making, really. And I will sort of tell you that we put law students and public health students together with various other graduate students from across grounds. So we have a small grounds campus, for those of you who don't know. So we often have architecture students, planning students, medical students, and the business students are always the best when you're teaching a course on values. And so the important thing we find is just to lay out some frameworks in the beginning, because what people quickly learn if you start with a case, and I'll give you an example of the case you start with in a minute, is that they know law frameworks, and they're very comfortable giving law answers to things. These are mostly 3Ls. But what we have to do is help them realize that law doesn't provide most of the answers in public health, good decision making, and what does as sort of an examination of the ethical or value dimensions in real world practice. And so we spend now a little bit of time in the beginning just giving the comparison of a ethics framework. Lawyers tend not to think ethics is sort of a field of study as rigorous as law. Maybe it isn't, but some people think it has to do with sort of the same kind of philosophical understanding of things and the same kind of rigor and analysis. So what we do is we deliberate, and we start off with the same kind of facts and options. And when either law doesn't provide the answer or reasonable minds disagree, we employ the same case-based management for law and ethics, and we do role-playing. But it is role-playing not with two sides, as in traditional law. It is role-playing around the table, as one would do in a hospital ethics committee, and we sort of pose the ethics committee for the health directors, and we have real health directors come in, we make up the cases, and so here is how we might start off. Now, this is not rocket science, but the point is, we are not focusing on teaching the law. We are focusing on teaching public health. And there is no better way to expose lawyers, law students, to ethical dimensions of public policy in general. No better way to teach social justice than to talk about public health cases. So suppose this will be how we'll start off a semester or a class. Suppose you're the advisor to the health officer in a medium-sized city in upstate New York experiencing syphilis. I mean, this is just a standard, very straightforward posing of the closing the bathhouse case. Everybody does it in some ways. It's the St. Mark's bath. But we just put it out there with teams and say, okay, this is right here in this town or right here in wherever. We say, figure it out. What are the legal parameters of it? So the law students take the lead in sort of figuring it out. The MPH students, who are sort of senior MPH students at this point, teach them. They work on this problem and teach them public health. And we have public health practitioners coming and going. We have very close relationships with all of our public health people. Last year we had our local epidemiologist come in and say, okay, here is the case. Go to it, teams. We had people giving chicken pox parties around the community. So they were kind of the hot thing. What do you do with chicken pox parties? Well, what are the legal dimensions of that? So we don't start with Jacobson. We wait for a case like that, real decision making in real time, and then people pull back and do this inductive learning that they are faced with then having to do, turn to our legal, our ethical frameworks for teasing, which we do, for teasing out the ethical or value dimensions of the cases. And we use the stakeholder approach, you know, who are all the stakeholders, who should be at the table, who are at the table, pull back and say, what are their values, what do they have at stake? Part of this is a humility experience for law students. I sat at way too many hospital ethics committees where there's an ethical case on the table and the ethics folks, everybody around the table, docs, everybody turns to the lawyer for the answer, and lawyers are always comfortable giving the answer. And so even when it's not a legal answer, it's all an ethical answer. And so it's really interesting for lawyers to struggle with their place at the table in a real world situation and that they don't know everything. Do you know what I mean? You have public health folks saying, wait a minute, if I have the authority, it's within the bounds, I'm not limited. In this case, I think it gives you that sort of understanding of the tremendous professional discretion grounded in values and ethics. And how do you make that determination? Who do you bring to the table? What questions do you ask? What is all the science that you need to know? So I think that you know, we just pull out why it is a much broader experience to do a field like public health law than just knowing the law. You know, it's, if you're going to be effective, and I think this is the true opportunity for public health law, is to train a cadre of lawyers who are humble about law isn't just the answer to everything. You certainly have to know it. Your role at the table is to know it, and to be so confident of knowing it and confident of who you are as a lawyer that you are comfortable being in that middle area of, you know, what you can do and why should you do it or not do it, right? It's really exciting for lawyers once they get the hang of it to be outside the world of the legal mind at the table knowing all the answers. So what does public health ethics offer? Because we do both at the same time. We also, and we teach public health at the same time, and we do lots of other things. We do, like, create the law. So we were the one state, Sue knows this, that had HPV requirement, and, you know, that wasn't a simple answer for the health department. So we have the health department to come in and pose that question, would you pass this law for requiring HPV? But, you know, ethics plays a significant role in our analysis, and what does it give you? It gives you, obviously, a vocabulary and guidance. Lawyers aren't schooled in that naturally. It helps them to think about what are some practical reasoning theories of justice, not, you know, abstract things. And balancing moral claims is similar to the process officials use in understanding and making public health cost-benefit trade-offs. This is a really important point because lawyers are, when they get pulled back, they always go to the utility model and cost-benefits, right, cost-benefits there. And, you know, quantifiable health gains or losses in public health means weighing, identifying, and balancing the moral interests at stake. It's the same kind of cost-benefit you're balancing. So, I mean, this is uncomfortable territory for a lot of people who are who like this is the law. So, but it's exciting. So we just always also teach public health ethics as in contrast to the other other ethics, bioethics, which is much more clinical focused. And you can see some of the benefits we sort of say come from our teaching of it this way. Fosters respectful deliberation about ethical tensions. Helps provide lawyers with rhetorical strategies to help in the policy arena and in the legislative arena when you're making the case. It's creative law, creative ethics, and policy formulation. And as I said, I think it provides you with a collegial respect for other professionals in the policy realm and sort of legal hubris. So we often draw on the 12 ethical principles of public health as ways of looking into sort of some of the issues. And we provide this framework. This is the framework we put out. We've refined it a little bit, but having a framework for lawyers is helpful for ethics because people think values and ethics are messy and everybody has their own and it's okay. No, I mean, you can be reasoned about it. And so we provide this. And again, the precedent law or ethics cases are really key. And so we walk through what are the legal precedents. And so we just for the bathhouse case, we then have people learn about nuisance law, and both public health and law students learn it together or look at it together. And then we ask people to evaluate the ethical dimensions of alternative courses of action. What are all the ways? Frieden had a wonderful memo out when he was in New York City director of looking at the different ways they had a case arise for bathhouse issues. And all of the options you can lay out besides closing it. And, you know, there are alternative courses of action. How do you argue what and why? And it's not just numbers, lawyers. You got to come up with other reasons. And then the ethical justifications are, this looks very similar to the law. But key is it's public justification is what matters. And so getting people comfortable with making the case in other than legal terms, and often other than rights terms. Anyway, advantages of integrating law and ethics, it encourages ethical reflection within the legal political context. I mean, I think people, if you never do anything else with public health, you leave this class having an understanding of, in a new way, of what do we owe each other as a people? What are our obligations and how do we think differently about our roles as legal professionals and health professionals in this political legal context? And sensitizes learners to the complex multidimensional context of issues in public health practice is key. Anyway, I think we have lots of time now for discussion. So, you know, these are just stakeholder analysis, deliberative, prioritizing values, and real-world cases from our own area or ones we've gotten from the CDC. I've just finished being at the CDC for 4 years and heading their ethics, or chairing their ethics committee. And the whole time we spent, as you all are doing with law, developing cases from practice that elucidate the ethical dimensions of practice. And we realized that ethics and law needs to be taught together because you have to lay out the legal dimensions or parameters, and then you talk about, now what do you do? You know the big space you work in. What do you do? So, thank you.
Okay, well, we do have time for questions. I'd like to say and really thank all of our panelists. I actually would like to adopt all of these courses at Georgia State. I mean, this is such an opportunity for our students. It's unbelievable. And I know that deans and associate deans and law faculty feel quite beleaguered these days, you know, what with the criticisms of Carnegie, the concerns about the employability of our graduates, the pressures from employers to want practice-ready attorneys, the burnout of 3L students. And what I saw in this panel were really courses that address all of those challenges. I mean, I really think that public health law offers such an opportunity. I mean, maybe other legal fields do as well. I think public health law is best. I mean, you know, in terms of just offering to students connections with the community, whether it's the local health department or the state, you know, health department, those kinds of connections, the practical, real life, ethical, practical, political, as well as legal and public health dimensions of problems. I mean, it's really, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is really smart to put their money, you know, behind developing legal education, public health education, to really foster innovations in this kind of programming, because they address so many of the critiques of legal education that are currently circulating. So anyway, that's my pitch. But questions for our panelists? Lance in the back. Oh, well. Yeah, no, no. Go ahead.
You want to first? I think
as far as a practitioner, versus the full time faculty, I actually feel in many respects like I'm a practitioner because of the nature. I run the two centers that I run, and I have such a deep relationship with the, we call them customers and that client that I serve. So I think it's just, I happen to be situated at the law school and I have a faculty title and the like. But I think that you can do all of what, gets done. It's just, obviously, then you have two masters. And I think that's the really difficult part of it, right? But at the end of the day, if I have problem students who are taking so much of my time, that's my job, right? For I think an adjunct, it can be more challenging because the time demands are so difficult and you have this whole other job that you're doing, on top of things. But as far, I would say, it's probably happening more than it's happening with traditional faculty as far as teaching clinically, because in law school, clinics are not necessarily a favored thing among
And then that's what you have.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was just going to say, Michael was a professor at New England Law at the time we taught our course, but Julie and I co-taught at William Mitchell. We're adjunct professors. We work with our nonprofits based on campus there, but we're employees of a nonprofit. So we're adjunct professors there, and I can vouch for what Kathy said too. So I don't even really think of her as a professor. I think of her as a
And to answer your question briefly with respect to Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, they are all over having academics and practitioners collaborate across all of their projects. And in specifically, if your question is with respect to this faculty fellowship that we're developing, they're very much looking, to collaborations between academia and practitioners.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to suggest coming to the business meeting at 261 to network with in room 261 to network with folks, and the social at 8 o'clock is in room 209. I got that in. Okay, Lance.
What I'm wondering is, to what extent, as you were setting these courses up, did you get any pushback from faculty, because they're not the typical course design that you see, and how do you either overcome those areas of resistance, or any thoughts about how to package this in a way that's particularly attractive to faculty who might be moving more slowly to new innovations than you might want them to?
My answer is really easy. I pay for myself. So I'm fully soft money. I'm fully grant funded. So it was a matter of putting money into the institution, and so there was little pushback. We're also situated, as I indicated, on a campus where health professions, and we have a law and healthcare program that is very embedded in our culture at Maryland. And so I think that it's easier to start with institute, and we have a strong clinical program such that it was not a hard sell. I'm not actually that unique among my colleagues. We have a very big clinic faculty and several others doing policy work. So, but I think that the question is status then of those clinicians versus stand-up faculty or the like. And at Maryland, we have, I think a fairly collegial relationship so that they actually, but what we have learned in the clinic for us is to talk to our colleagues when they're doing talks at our, assume you have faculty forums and the like, and it's mostly stand-up faculty talking about their, article, law review, Harper Law Review articles that they're working on. When we come and we talk about the work that we're doing with our students, the collaborative work that we're doing, they are so enthusiastic in response to that we can melt away some of that pushback by acting like people belong and taking up part of what our job too is in communicating with them about what we do.
Yeah,
From my perspective, the school, I think, was very supportive. There was sort of a logistical issue of having to figure out how we could get our classes to be at the same time so that we could communicate, which was not that hard to figure out. I think my school was very enthusiastic about the idea of students presenting to external audiences and sort of getting the school's name out there. So on that side, it was easy. I think you're right, though, that the challenge in terms of getting other professors interested in doing this type of work is a challenge. And I think there were some people who were really interested, and actually a couple of people came to the presentation and were very supportive. And there's stuff we're not going to be. I'm not sure there's a mix to that.
So to answer your question, Lance, from my perspective, I went back to conflict management school in order to learn to navigate resistance and pushback. I think it's an excellent question because I think, you're not necessarily going to find cheerleaders among, either your colleagues or the deans or, and how much is it going to cost? And, in some senses, the recession has been bad for law schools. In some senses, it's been good for those programs that can justify themselves in terms of these are where their employment opportunities, these are where there are opportunities for the kinds of courses that will make them practice ready and so on. Part of what we're going to be doing at the faculty fellowship program in the summer is talking about how do you navigate resistance to change as part of the skill set, that academic leaders need to have. Yeah, Ross.
Requirements that are coming up. I know, for example, with medical schools, now it's interdisciplinary education is huge. You can provide that. You can walk right in and say, hey, look, this is the kind of thing that can help you meet these mission goals. So, those are the kinds of things that I've used over the years to integrate more, legal issues and social determinants, public health issues in medical schools, and now working with law schools. School of Public Health to bring ethics and policy into law schools and run into the School of Public Health and vice versa. So it's just, you get them where they, that's a little Machiavellian, but at the same time, it's...
No, in conflict management speak, we call that framing. And, you have to be aware of your audience. For example, it doesn't necessarily sell in law schools that you're interdisciplinary. And in fact, I've had former deans say, I don't get what your interdisciplinary work charity gets for law school. Medical school is totally different, probably public health's different. And, so you have to frame it in terms of what sells to the folks you want to sell to. And that can be, you have to think about it. It's not just that it's the right thing to do, which of course it is, but how do you, convey that takes a thoughtfulness.
And also, we really haven't had pushback because it's kind of a nice thing for third years to be able to have something that gets them excited again. But we also looked, when you say win-win and how do you frame it, we stepped up and are willing to satisfy a writing requirement, which is like a lot of work and reading these papers. So you find little things that make you like pay your dues a little bit with the course. And I don't know what it is in each institution, but I'm sure you can find some little something to offer.
I think to build on what Ross said, also, it is what students are interested in. And so your best friends can be the admissions staff. As well as, career services. Thank you. That's exactly who I was thinking of. So they can be your best friends because they can be the ones that say, we need this. Our students do. I can market this. I can't tell you how many times I'm featured in a stupid brochure. I shouldn't say that. I don't know why that came out because I get annoyed by having to have my picture taken. But because our stuff sells is sexy for admission purposes, right? And so sometimes you can, back your way into that by you're constantly up on the news feed, and the PR department probably is interested in the work that we're doing because they can understand and feed that out to the community in a different way. They can an 80-page law report, right?
Other questions?
Thank you, guys. That was great.
Yeah, that was great.